lived several lives within all these years, and we wanted to introduce three gentlemen who have been a part of telling Jack's story, of immersing themselves in the world of 24. So we're excited to have Jim Swallow, who wrote Deadline, Dayton Ward, Trial by Fire, and Dave Mack, who wrote Rogue. If you want to hold up the books, if you have them, we'd love to see them for people to find.
Mine's classified. You can't see it.
So. It's so classified. We couldn't see it.
Eyes only.
No, but I've got so, yours.
Keith's got mine. There we go.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Keith, please hold to it. And of course, Keith is joining us on the podcast today. We are good friends who met through the 24 Universe Facebook group, and we speak the same language. I always say, in a group of people who are fans of 24, it's like a room of people that talk Klingon. And we'll say, you know, Sherry Palmer. And we don't have to explain who Sherry Palmer is because people know who Sherry Palmer is. So we are excited. Thank you. First of all, welcome to the podcast. We are happy to have you here joining
us. Thanks for having us on. Thanks for having us on.
Good to be here.
The way we start is, how did you get to 24? I mean, when I look at the body of work of each of you.
One, two.
Like Sesame Street. But when I look at the body of work that all of you have done, it covers so much, and certainly in the science fiction realm and among others. And then there's 24. So my question is, how did you get to 24, each of you?
So who's gonna start with this? I'll
start. You weren't the first of the 24 books from
so tour. We worked previously with a very talented fellow, a great editor by the name of Marco Palmieri.
Okay.
When we worked on our Star Trek tie-ins, and Marco had jumped ship and gone over to a different publisher. And he reached out to us and said, well, we have the license for the 24 IP. I was wondering, Jim, if you and Dave and Dayton would be interested in writing a trilogy of 24 novels. And I think we kind of collectively bit his hand off, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. I mean, there was no question of any of us saying like, oh, well, I don't know, maybe, you know, because...
Let me think about it, yeah.
Yeah, we were all big fans of the franchise. And that was it. We just said like, yeah, absolutely. You know, we straight off at on the dotted line, Dayton, what was the order of the books that we came in? I can't remember. Was it you second or third?
Well, what
I was
happened?
Second and Dayton yeah, Dave was third, was second, but yours, Dayton's is a prequel.
That's right. Yeah. So,
but I got asked twice. I had to turn him down the first time.
Oh really?
Because it was a scheduling conflict. They had asked me if I was interested. And Marco said, I recommended you to this other editor who's going to do it. And I said, I'm my plate's full. I don't have time. And so I went and cried in my corner while they moved on to talk to Jim and or Dave. But then they circled back around and they said, okay, we've got Jim on board for a book and Dave on board for a book. And we've got a third book. Are you interested? And I just threw caution to the wind and said, yeah, you're not going to ask me a third time. So I'm going to find a way to make it work. So
it all comes down to Marco. I actually dedicated my 24 novel to Marco. It says, for Marco, who put my name in the hat.
Mm-hmm. That's basically, yeah.
That's gratitude.
Marco's good people.
He's a good guy.
Awesome. He's like, you know, there are editors that you work with when you write time. Some of them, you know, just kind of like shine stuff straight through. And it's like, get it down, get it out the door. That's fine. You know, and as long as you can deliver a competent job of work, that's fine. But then there are other editors who are really, truly collaborators, people who just elevate the quality of your work, the kind of guys who, you know, really have your back. And yeah. And Marco is definitely one of those.
Jane, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'll second that. I mean, Marco basically asked me to help him co-create the Star Trek Vanguard book series, most of which I co-wrote in alternating volumes where I would write the odd-numbered volumes and Dayton and his sometimes writing partner, Kevin Delmore, would write the even-numbered volumes, and for which James wrote a mirror universe version of our work. But Marco really pushed me to elevate my craft. He said, you know, don't stagnate. Don't just be satisfied with where you are. He pushed me to write things that I thought of were outside my comfort zone or outside my skill set. He said, because that's how you grow. And to this day, I call him sensei or senpai, because I really do consider him a teacher and a mentor in that regard.
Wow. And Jim said that you were fans of 24. Were you hardcore fans? Were you caught up? Was it something you had to kind of delve into? Or where were you each at when you were asked to do these projects?
Day one, episode one, I was a fan.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I was in from the jump.
Yeah.
I was in from jump. I was all caught up when I was approached.
Yeah.
I also like being the kind of tie-in nerd that I am, as much as, you know, I write tie-in fiction, I read it too. So I had read all of the comics.
I've done all that.
Track down all of the novels as well. Yep. So in fact, back when HarperCollins originally had the license to do the 24 declassified novels, I had actually reached out to them and you know, crazily enough, pitched them a Jack Bauer in London novel.
Really?
This was way before Live Another Day.
Right.
And, you know, it kind of got kicked around. They were like, eh. And then the line kind of folded in on itself. And that was that. And I remember at the time thinking, that's on my bucket list of IPs that I love, that I would love to write. And I thought, well, that ship has sailed.
Right.
But, you know, in this game,
you never say never.
Sometimes the ship comes back around again, you know. And so here we were.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, too, because in those days, you would have never thought Jack's going to leave L.A. Everything had been set in L.A., That's where the action was happening and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But, you know, to go from Washington to New York to London was, you know, signaled a whole new direction for the franchise, for sure.
Yeah.
And like we took them even farther afield once we got our hands on
them. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Like Jim, I was reading the declassified novels when they were putting them out, and I had reached out to the editor there, but I was not as far along as I am at the point where Tor came along. I wasn't a known entity or known quantity like I think I am now. But and plus they had pretty much locked up. I think they only had 3 or 4 authors in a rotation doing what eventually came 11 books, 11 or 12 books, I think. So I mean they were pretty tightly wound. And you know, editors of tie-ins will by and large stick with the people they know they can trust to do these things because the timetables and the schedules and the demands from the studio are so crazy. Tie-ins are not a proving ground for untested talent, generally speaking.
Right, right. I mean, the whole, you know, area, I'm a kid who grew up, not a kid anymore, but I grew up on tie-ins. I would get every book from the library. Those bridged the stories in between, you know, to answer those kind of things. What was it that excited you about doing and taking on another franchise coming from, you know, kind of franchise world?
Go ahead.
Certainly a beloved character like Jack Bauer as well.
Dave, you want
to
jump in?
I think for me, it was just I was glad to get out of doing something Star Trek for a while. I was kind of Star Trek'd out, and I wanted to do something that felt a bit more grounded. I wanted to do more of a classic thriller because I'd never written one, and it was a fun challenge. I had to do a lot of research, a lot more research than I would have ever had to do for a Star Trek novel. But in a way, that worked out to be a good thing. I sort of expanded my knowledge of the subject matter. And my 24 novel, Rogue, actually ended up winning a Scribe Award. So I'm pretty proud of that. It was my first Scribe Award.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. We're a little late, but congratulations.
It was 5 years ago. So.
Mm-hmm. 5 years and 24 years, though. I mean,
it's probably a year
and a half ago.
I have to say, I pretty much would echo Dave right there, is that I'd been writing my own thriller fiction for a while, but I hadn't kind of completed it. And I was, in between doing tie-in stuff, I was trying to kind of get together the material to send out to pitch my own original fiction. But I wanted to write thrillers. And then the 24 novel came up, and I thought, well, here's an opportunity for me to kind of test fire my writing outside of sci-fi and try doing something in the thriller space, but also in a fictional world that I knew really well, that I felt comfortable in. So that's why I jumped into to do Deadline. Deadline was, I didn't even originally have a title for it. It was just, I had it written in my calendar. I wrote 24 Deadline. And I was like, hey, you know what? That's
kind of works.
That's a pretty damn good title.
I should use that.
Ta-da.
And so that's where that came from. And I was specifically asked, as it was the first book out of the gate, to find a way to kind of marry up with what had gone before.
Right.
So rather than doing a story that kind of ran up to the start of Live Another Day, they said, well, you remember that last scene in the last season beforehand, which, you know, we get that last shot of Jack looking up.
Yes.
You know, we see it in the drone, and it's like, tell us what happened next. So I thought, okay, so my novel picks up 1 hour later.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, because Jack never has one good day, does he? You know, and
no.
And so I wrote the story of, like, you know, how he gets out of New York and where he goes from there, and sort of I guess I sort of kicked open the door to the wider world of 24 that Dave talked about there, that gave us an opportunity to say, okay, let's take him beyond
the
kind of storytelling that we know and take him to different places. So Dave takes him all the way to Africa, I believe.
Yeah, Somalia, dealing with Somali pirates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Dayton, you know, you kind of turn the clock back the other way and show us a story right from kind of his early years.
Yeah. And that wasn't the original plan. I was looking back through my email archive while we're chatting about this, and apparently they had the license for quite a while before they settled on the three books that we were going to do. Because I got asked about this in like late 2014 or early 2015, or no, it had to be early 2014 because I was still working in my corporate job. And that's why I had to pass, because I was under contract and I didn't have time. And so it moved on. I just assumed that they had moved on to some other writer that wasn't one of us. And then it cycled back around after I left my corporate job and you guys had already been pinged for your two books. And that was the second opportunity that I got. Which is when I said, oh, well, yeah, because I was looking for work. I was like Dave was talking about earlier, I was looking for any kind of freelance job at that point, and they came along at just the right time. And it was a chance to do something that wasn't Star Trek, because, you know, we had been doing a lot of Star Trek at that point. So the original plan, as I understood it, was Jim was going to set us in motion, picking up after day eight. Dave's book takes place, what is it, about 2 years, 2.5 years after?
I think I have it here. It's the following events occur 1 year, seven months,
there you
and
go.
23 days after Jack Bauer was forced into exile and left the United States.
There you go. And so
all times are East Africa time.
And then the original intent for me was to pick it up later, but still within that 4 year gap between day eight and Live Another Day, but be consistent with what Jim and Dave had written. So come up with a storyline that might start threading the needle or getting us on the path to Live Another Day. And I submitted an outline that did all of that. And Fox liked it, but they sat on it for a while. And then they came back and said, okay, we like your idea, but we really want you to do a prequel. I'm like, oh, okay, that's all right. Good. You know, okay then. Yeah, no, so they liked my whole Okinawa story because that's where it takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So I just retooled it so that now Jack is a very junior CIA agent before he's ever CTU, but most of the other stuff. And then I got to... It actually ended up working in my favor because it was closer in time to when I actually lived on the island. So I was able to draw on memories and details that I recalled from that point in time versus what it would be like in the modern day. It was a lot of fun, but it was definitely an interesting pivot because I figured, okay, one more book and then Live Another Day and everybody's happy. And nope, they change their minds because that's what you do when you own IP.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, exactly. Yeah. The word you said is pivot. Yeah. The idea of, okay, now here's where we're going to take it.
Right. And when you're a freelance writer working on somebody else's IP, your response to these types of questions is, sure thing, I can take care of that, no problem.
Right. So.
I can improve it by doing this.
Well, and they floated the idea in the last several years of doing a prequel, of doing a, you know, every once in a while you hear about the idea of doing a young Jack Bauer series, similar to what they did with Young Indiana Jones or something like that. It hasn't come into fruition yet, but you never know. Absolutely.
Never know.
Clearly, the three of you collaborate together, well. You play together well from what we've observed already.
we've occasionally gotten on each other's nerves.
I mean, I'm somebody that grew up on Star Trek fiction.
There you go.
Are there parallels to... you know, writing science fiction or Star Trek fiction specifically for a dedicated fan base that knows everything and you know, line and verse and everything else, to going and writing for Jack Bauer and writing for the 24 universe?
Well, you definitely want to have your continuity straight in both.
Right,
cases.
Right.
I mean, the fans appreciate a little bit of fan service. So I managed to work in, you know, just a single scene, a cameo appearance by Mandy.
Okay.
And then beyond that, you know, dropping in references to the episodes just to ground it in the universe. Like when we first catch up with Jack in chapter one, we mentioned that he's under an alias and he's pretending, and he's basically doing it to infiltrate the weapons industry run by this guy named Carl Rask, who was established in Live Another Day.
Yeah.
So you need to have some sort of a grounding in the universe, so that it's not just a generic thriller, but specifically a 24 thriller. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of effort you would make in a Star Trek novel to make sure that you are representing not only the characters correctly, but the universe. Right. It's got to be not just a generic science fiction novel, but specifically a Star Trek novel.
It's like
I agree.
It's a question of kind of texture, right? You know, it's there has to be there's a certain feel. It's like when people say about art, right? You go, what is art? Well, you know it when you see it, right? And you know, you know what 24 is, and you know how that show feels, and you know how those characters should move in that environment. And it does it feel 24-ish, right? And if it doesn't, you know it.
If the
characters don't talk or move right, or the pace of it feels off, it's not 24. And it's hard to kind of quantify that stuff sometimes to people. You know, it's a skill that we've had to develop as tie-in writers, is that you look at a franchise and you go, what's the essential ness-ness of this? What's the thingness of it?
Right, right.
And it's finding that. And when you find that, you know, you can kind of tell a story in that world. But it's a skill that's hard to develop and kind of hard to kind of quantify. But when you can do it, you can do it, right? And then that's why kind of like tie-in writers, you see a lot of people in the same names turning up as tie-in writers, because if you develop that skill, you can kind of apply it to different universes. So, you know, that skill that we developed working for like Star Trek and what have you, we just applied that to writing in 24. And because we're all fans of the franchise, because we know the characters, we know the worlds and the voices I guess I would say for me, it was kind of like putting on a pair of comfortable shoes.
Right.
It's like, oh, I know this world. I feel happy here, and I feel I can tell a story that was a lot of fun.
I feel the same way. I mean, I don't know that being a fan of a property is necessarily a requirement to be a good tie-in writer, but I do think it's an asset. Mm-hmm. And sure. I don't typically look for tie-in work if I'm not already a fan of the franchise in question. I mean, there are plenty of shows out there that have huge fan bases and lots of merchandise, but it's just not my thing. So right. when somebody calls and says, hey, would you write a blob, you know, an XYZ novel? I'm not a fan of that show or that film or that franchise, and I don't feel like I could do it justice, because the fans of that property are just as passionate as Star Trek fans or 24 fans or Star Wars fans. And they're going to know if you're faking it or trying to phone it in.
Right.
Or, you know, it's anybody who underestimates the audience for these books is committing a grave mistake, in my opinion. I think it's not a good idea to try to think you're going to get one over on this fan base. They're dedicated. They're passionate. They watch it. They know it. And they know when you're a poser.
Right. Well, going back to my comparison, they know if you can't speak Klingon. Right.
Yes. You know, and I like Jim and Day, I'm a huge fan of the show. And when I get asked to do something like this, I want to do right by it, because I don't want them to think that we are just taking the money for taking the job for the money. No, it's got to be something I'm going to enjoy, because my name's going to be on it. You know, they're not going to sell it as a Ward novel. They're going to sell it as a 24 novel, but it's still my name on there. I got to be proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want to be the guy who phones it in, right? Because we've all read tie-in novels that frankly have been phoned in.
Right.
That feel like, you know, that they weren't put together with love, or that they've been screwed around with so much by the licensor that the book is just not that great.
Lifeless or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and we've none of us want to be the person who kind of drops the ball, as we're all fans of this. And also I've got to be honest about this. The fact that all three of us were working on this, there's kind of a, you know, we all have a friendly rivalry here, and none of us wanted to be the one who didn't bring their A game.
Right.
None of us wanted to be the one that everyone went, those two were great. That one's
This one was the Crystal Skull of the series. Sorry, I threw that in there. Sorry, I couldn't think of the other one.
Worse than the Temple of Doom.
I couldn't think of Temple of Doom. Yeah, but I don't know. Anyway, I'll pull back. Forget I said that entirely. But as you said, you don't want to be the one that.
You don't want to be the guy. You know,
we've had pretty good responses as well from the fan base. I think is, you know, everybody kind of who's read the book, who's commented certainly to me, and the comments I've seen about David Dayton's books have all been like, oh, these guys get 24. They know the characters. They love the characters. They've written something that feels like it stands in that world on its own, you know?
Yeah.
I think when they asked me to do a prequel, I realized I kind of had to throttle things back a little bit, because if I wrote a fully formed Jack Bauer, you know, at that point in time, I think it would feel fake.
Right.
So I kind of treated it like Casino Royale, the way they portrayed, Daniel Craig's James Bond. So there are little touches in the book that I feel like one of the questions that people ask me was, how come every chapter didn't start with the time, the clock? And to me, that's such a signature thing of 24. Yeah. It's like the James Bond theme, or it's like, Bond walking across the screen and the gun barrel.
Right.
It's one of those things that he has to earn when you're rebooting him in a fashion that I was basically doing. So what I didn't do was I didn't put the clock there, but I made several mentions throughout the book. And of course, each chapter, there's 24 chapters. That part I stuck with, but I was like, okay, I won't have a clock at the beginning of the hour, but I will make subtle references throughout the book about what time it is or how much time has transpired since those events. And he'll earn the clock in a later story. He's not there yet. Yeah. And then I think I made a comment at the end of the book, like, well, tomorrow's another day or something to that effect, and even my editor was like, okay, that's pretty funny. I'm gonna let you keep that one. But I mean, it was an interesting challenge to try to thread that needle of, okay, because they wanted a prequel, in their head, they were thinking like River Phoenix, Indiana Jones, from the Last Crusade. I'm like, well, no, Jack's not a newbie at that point in time. He was, he's former LAPD. He was Special Forces. He was in the CIA. So he's got skills. That's why CTU recruited him. And so once I convinced the folks at licensing that, he's not a complete newbie. He's not going to just learn all this on the fly. I'm like, but we can still make it a proto 24 story. Hmm. It was a lot of fun. It was a fun needle to thread.
What was it like collaborating with, I know, Jim, for example, in your acknowledgments, you were talking about Evan Katz and Manny Coto. Being able to collaborate with Fox and being able to understand the characters. So I know like Carl Rask being introduced to Live Another Day. Did you guys have to get permission to use certain characters? Chase is a good example in Deadline, someone we haven't seen since season 3. If that's someone, that you had to get permission to use.
No, they were pretty good about it. I mean, there was no point where anybody said like, this is off the table. I think because probably we didn't pitch anything that was too wild and crazy. I think we understood the strictures of it. I mean, early on, I had a little bit of email conversation with the people at Fox about what their intentions were, and as I showed you earlier with this, they sent me some early scripts from Live Another Day, and you can see these are printed on special kind of red paper that meant that if anything leaked, it would have my name written all over it, so they would know it was me who did it. But of course, because I wasn't writing a story that kind of went straight up to that narrative, I didn't really need to refer a lot to what the Live Another Day stuff. But what they did give me the opportunity to do was go back the other way and look at the kind of the bag of toys that is 24 and say, well, what has been left behind? We got to bring Mandy back, who is such a great character. Mm-hmm. They used her as well. And I wanted to find an interesting way to kind of drop her into the story. Because she's such fun, and it's also the name of my wife too. So
awesome!
So having her turn up as a murderous evil killer is just kind of a funny joke to me.
Enjoy it a little too much, maybe.
but bringing in Chase and just referring to stuff like the fact that a nuclear bomb went off in Valencia in one season.
Right.
And then what everybody forgot about that a nuke went off in California. And I just wanted to touch back on that idea and say, well, let's look at that and let's look at what happened to Chase and find a way to bring him back into the story. And the road that he travels in Deadline, they allowed me to do some interesting things with the character. I'm not going to say exactly what, no spoilers here, right? But I was really amazed. I kind of said, well, can I do this? And they went, yeah, sure. And I was like, can I do this? And I kind of pushed the line a little further and they went, sure. And I went, well, can I do this? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, great. So all bets are off. Okay. But that was really nice. They were just very, very giving. And that's exactly what you want as a tie-in writer, because you want to feel like the work that you create at the end of the day really is part of that world, not just kind of something ancillary, that it threads into the narrative, dovetails of what's coming afterwards. So I love the idea that maybe someone could, watch day 8 and then the next day pick up my novel and start reading. And it's like, feels like that's one experience that just keeps on carrying on.
Yeah. Well, I like how you've all mentioned Mandy, because when anybody asks me who your favorite character of the series was, my answer is automatically Mandy, because we didn't know anything about her you know, until you kind of fleshed her out a little bit. We didn't really even know her name was Mandy. We understood from episode one of the pilot that she said her name was Mandy, but we didn't know that. And then she pops in, you know, three or four times throughout the series, and every time she does, it's a major impact. But we still don't know anything about her, you know, or knew very little about her. So the ability to flesh out a little more about her is extremely important, because she's an enigma on so many levels. You know, who she's working for, what her motivations, all that kind of stuff was not covered within the series.
She's got this great plot function in the show, is that every time you want to shake things up a bit, she parachutes into the story.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's Mandy. Something's going down, right?
You know, first thing she does is pull a pin on a grenade.
Yeah. I mean, that's your introduction. You're expecting, and that the pilot. I've watched it so many times since I've been doing the podcast. Yeah. But the idea of, you know, somebody on this plane is involved in something. You don't expect. It's like a Marie Warner situation. You don't expect it to be her. You expect it to be anybody else that's, you know, on the plane that day. But the idea of exploring Mandy's storyline is extremely exciting. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And to be able to have the ability to use a character like that, or to bring in Chase, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I know bringing Agent Kilner, I mean, that's a character that shows up in one scene or two scenes in season 7. And the fact that he's a main character in Deadline, I was like, what made you think to use that character?
Well, I was going back through the 24 Wikipedia page, looking for a kind of, like, you know, I had a few character slots to fill, and I needed someone who could fill that role. And I thought, well, I can create a brand new character. And I did create a bunch of new characters. But Kilner, I just thought, you know what, I could just put him in that story, and I could expand this guy a little bit. So I gave him a first name, which was the first name of the actor who played him. And it gave me the opportunity to kind of have his previous experience with Jack reflect back into the story. So he's in this group of people who are hunting down Jack, and he's the only guy in the group who goes, well, you know, I've met this guy, and what people are saying about him is not true. And he's the one guy who's on Jack's side, while everybody else is against him. And by choosing a character who'd been in the show, that feels realistic. Because if I'd created a completely new character who was a friend of Jack Bauer, I'd have to kind of build a lot more explanation into that. Whereas if you're a fan of the show, you go, oh, I remember that guy in that, like, one scene where he's in the car with Jack and they're having a conversation. And it's a great little moment as well. And I just thought it's an opportunity here to take a guy who is just a bit part player and build him out into a much more interesting character.
Well, you got to remember, most of what he does is classified. A lot of times the people who are second guessing him are people who don't know him personally, have not worked with him before, are just encountering him, and usually the first thing he does is challenge their authority in some way, which is not a way to endear yourself to people, as I found out the hard way in my corporate career. I mean, Jack is a strong flavor, and he's not always easy to work with. And by the time you figure out he has a propensity for being right, he's probably also ruffled.
It's one of those things with a character, you know, a universe that's fleshed itself out. The question I have is, as a writer, how many things does Jack Bauer have to do before people really start to trust his instincts? I mean, how many times do you have to save the world before people go, well, let's defer to him? There's a great scene in season 8 when one of the CTU agents says, who's Jack Bauer? And the other two just look at him like this. And then they almost don't acknowledge, like a tree falling in the forest. But what does Jack have to do for people to finally believe that he knows what he's talking about? Now, the fans, Jim hinted that the fans find you, right? You've had interactions with 24 fans over the years. Yeah. Is it, in comparison, again, comparing the two, I don't think we talk about the Star Trek 24 comparison enough, certainly on our podcast, because Manny Coto. Right? We talk about the RoboCop connection to 24, but we don't really explore. I mean, you each of you brought in more of a Star Trek connection. But comparing your interactions with Star Trek fans and 24 fans, what's your take on those?
It's kind of like...
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead, Dan.
No, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to say.
Okay.
So I should probably shut up.
I was going to say, you know, my kind of entry into 24 was actually through La Femme Nikita, a lot of the people who worked on that show. And so I knew people who were in the fan base of that, who kind of migrated to 24. And they were, you know, just
the whole point of the show,
the hardest of the hardcore fans.
Right. Yeah.
But they just, they had such kind of joy and love for these characters, even though the show is quite grim and dark. It's crazy how the fans, are just have so much love for the show and the characters in it. And they care really deeply for them. So I had, a few friends of mine who were fans were like saying, you know, what are you going to put Jack through the ringer? I'm like, well, yes, that's like on the label, right? You know, in fact, I did get dared by somebody I knew said, like, you know, all the stuff that never happens in an episode of 24, could you put it in the novel? So I said, okay. So I had a scene where Jack goes to sleep. He runs out of ammunition and he loses cell phone service. And, you know, because I didn't do that one. So, you know, that was, you know, so that was kind of, I think, a little bit of a challenge from sort of the fanish friends. But generally, I haven't had anybody kind of come to me and right. say, like, I thought you did a bad job, or you don't get 24, or this isn't what the novel's about. And no negativity. It's always been really positive, really strong.
Yeah, I've had pretty good feedback from the 24 fans who've read Rogue. Although I seem to have a knack for excavating the fans who are self-taught experts in firearms or cars, who just want to point out that one little error. It's like, well, technically this weapon wouldn't have done this, or technically you had the wrong type of cable here. Actually, that car has this, that, and the other thing, braking system, so that wouldn't have. I'm like, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the thing about those guys is, you know, the story about the character Q from the James Bond novels. So the story goes is that
right.
Ian Fleming writing a Bond novel, and this guy wrote him a letter, and he said, you know, the gun you have Bond using there is a lady's gun. She'd be using a Walther PPK. It's a much better gun. And so Fleming went, well, you know what? I'm going to keep you on tap now. And so every time he had a gun question, he would pester that guy about his gun questions. And I think that is, so if ever anybody says to me, like, oh, you know, you got that thing wrong, I'm like, okay, you are now on my Rolodex of experts.
You just volunteered yourself.
You just volunteered yourself, right? So it's like, you know something about this, or you got that thing wrong. Okay, well, tell me what I did wrong. And next time I'm going to be calling you in the middle of the night going, what would happen if I blew this thing up or I drove this car off a cliff? You know about this.
And their answer will be, who is this?
At 4 a.m.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're my consultant. Yeah. Yeah,
monkey, I need answers.
Wow. No, I think it's, I'm just looking up the name. I cannot remember the name of the first Pierce Brosnan. When you brought up James Bond, the first thing I thought was, I'm trying to remember the name of the first James Bond that Pierce Brosnan did.
Goldeneye.
Goldeneye has the scene. I was at a friend's place, and my dad and I were big Bond fans. We watched it from the beginning, but I was watching Goldeneye for the first time at my friend's house. And that was it opened with James Bond going off the motorcycle and down over the cliff and flying, you know, catching up to the plane that was going down and getting in and pulling it up out of a dive. And I went, and this is what I said, oh, come on. And my buddy said the best thing he ever could have said to me, there's the door. He said,
no, you're telling me there was a stunt in GoldenEye where Bond takes a motorcycle, goes off a cliff, lands it on a plane that's flying by.
No.
He jumps off the bike
and lands on the plane.
And then free falls.
He jumps off the bike.
He free falls to catch up to the plane.
And the velocity allows the velocity of himself to catch up to the plane that was plummeting, and he gets into the pilot seat.
I'm just wondering how much of that
don't think about it.
Inspired the one in the new Mark Wahlberg movie on Netflix, Infinite. It's like a stunt where he takes a motorcycle, jumps it off a cliff, lands the bike on the wing of a massive plane that's flying by, skids out, the thing tilts,
no, he takes
a knife, and now he's hanging onto the wing of the plane. It sounds like there's a lot of, like, there's maybe a lineage. There's like, I wouldn't call it a lawsuit, but I think there's maybe an inspiration.
Need to watch
homage.
This.
I feel like there might be a bit of an homage or
homage.
A creative bit of DNA. But that's interesting.
Yeah.
I remember.
I mean, I've told some of the creators of 24, look, we're on split screen talking right now. I think Zoom owes 24
yeah, no kidding.
That's probably why my Zoom account hasn't been working lately, because I dared to say that on Zoom. But, you know, we're in split screen. This is the best way to talk about 24.
One of my favorite stories about fan disconnect with reality within the confines of a film is we were seeing Terminator 2 in the theater. This is how old I am. And the motorcycle chase. Or, I'm sorry. John Connor's being chased by the T-1000 who's driving the tractor trailer truck, right? And then Arnold shows up on the motorcycle and all that kind of stuff. And they jump down into the aqueduct. And, you know, the Terminator, the T-1000 drives the truck through the guardrail and down into the aqueduct, dropping down to the aqueduct, crashing into the aqueduct, all the concrete. And at one point, the guy in front of me yelled, "Oh, come on, that's bullshit." And I'm like, okay, you were okay with the time traveling liquid metal board, you know. None of that tripped anything. Well,
because we don't know what the capabilities of the liquid metal Terminator are, but he does know the limitations of that model of truck.
But
that truck is a known
GMC
element.
Or that
Mack
truck with that engine. But I just remember that so clear. Was his red line, buddy. And, you know, Mack trucks can't do that.
The Lethal Weapon movies where I bought every dumb thing they did right up to the point where they jumped off a bridge and landed on the deck of a ship after falling like 60 feet. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? You'd have broken every goddamn bone in your body.
Die Hard did that.
And I remember broken my wrist like a week before I went to see the movie while playing softball. I was sliding on grass and my weight hit the ground wrong and I basically broke my wrist. I'm watching these idiots jump off a bridge, McClane and Samuel Jackson's character, and they hit the deck and they roll out of it. I'm like, no, you just broke every bone in your goddamn body. No. You are not getting up from that
shit. I need to pause for a moment. And ponder the notion of Dave doing anything
else. Or drunk. Like. He's got to be drunk enough that you just go, loosey-goosey.
Drunk enough to do it. And all I'm saying is that I needed my friend to give me that wake up call to say, stop overanalyzing this. Yeah. Just enjoy it. Immerse yourself in the universe and just enjoy
it. How did they survive that fall? Well, obviously they are avatars of Shiva.
I mean, if you can get past the idea that everything is 10 minutes away from everything else in Los Angeles, no, regardless of traffic, everything else is minor.
I can believe that almost of LA, but not of New York. They were getting through New York traffic at a rate that's
unprecedented.
Quick. You're not traveling unless you're traveling interdimensionally. That
takes longer to make those trips in New York.
Right.
Well, I think there's a crossover there. I think there might be a 24 Star Trek or RoboCop crossover with the dimensions.
CTU is run by the Iconians.
And move cities and.
That was the Men in Black. The Men in Black.
If Jack Bauer had a transporter, I mean, my goodness.
Gary Seven and Jack Bauer. Here we go.
I mean, they have their own red shirts since before, so, you know.
Well, what did you grow up? Are you readers when you were kids? Were you TV watchers, movies? What inspired you? All of it. Yeah. What in particular?
I mean, obviously, I grew up with Trek and syndication. But, you know, I loved the James Bond movies. I loved all the action stuff. I used to watch SWAT and Adam 12 and Emergency. Yeah. So, I mean, I watched like Emergency, all the sort of classic 70s pulp action adventure TV, $6 Million Man, loved the Planet of the Apes books. But I was also reading pretty much everything I could get my hands on. The original Pierre Boulle version of Planet of the Apes. I was reading the tie-ins. The Beneath the Planet of the Apes tie-in is fantastic. It does by Michael Avalon. It's got a great ending. So I mean, I remember the first science fiction book I ever read was called Space Eagle. Just this silly kind of pulp novel, I guess probably written in the 60s, but I remember to this day it made an impact because I read it when I was 10. So yeah, I mean, I started with both movies and TV and books and comic books, all just sort of fueling my pop culture consciousness.
Sure.
Yep. Same here. Same. I'm about Dave and I aren't that far apart in age. We probably have very similar. I mean, that was the same drill, 70s and 80s kid. And I read when I was a teenager is when I discovered I was already reading science fiction, but I was also reading the odd mysteries or thriller or military type fiction. So I've found stuff like the Mac Bolan books, you know, the Men's Adventure. So you want to talk about gun porn, you know, when you can spend 6 minutes describing the cycle of operation of an M16 and things like that. But I mean, I read a lot of that stuff. And as a writer, I realized, well, now that I'm a writer, I kind of miss the heyday of those kinds of books because those things were everywhere.
I also read all the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. And I bought the Hardy Boys detective manual, like, which was like the guide to being a junior detective. And it had like chapters on how to do surveillance, how to tail people with a partner or a two or three person tail. It had chapters on drugs, telling me the difference between hallucinogens, sedatives, stimulants. I'm like, this is useful information here. But it like had also basic information about forensics that a kid could understand, like, you know, what are fingerprints? What is DNA? How is this stuff collected? How is it tested? So, I mean, I was big into that stuff too.
Yes, I was probably in, again, same kind of generation, you know, but growing up in the UK, so I had kind of slightly different sort of TV and comic book kind of stuff. So, as well as watching like American imports, so we would get shows like Bionic Man, you know, $6 Million Man, stuff like that. But we would get, we would have like the British kind of pulp shows. So we had like the Avengers, the New Avengers, or the Sweeney, which was kind of like, you know, that was sort of like hard bitten guys kicking in doors and shooting people, you know, the sort of like the tough guy British cop show. And then in terms of like comic books, funny enough, a comic book which is still going now, which I've actually managed to write for in my later years, Commando, which is these little kind of digest sized comic books, kind of two-fisted action adventure of sort of mostly British soldiers beating the hell out of Nazis. Or, you know, RAF fire pilots, that kind of thing, you know, but all kind of, you know, very much that sort of, you know,
I hate that sort of
two-fisted hero, takes no shit kind of guy in the kind of like the mold of sort of like characters like Jack Bauer.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. And also we did get a little bit of the kind of Mac Bolan stuff sort of trickle over into the UK. And I remember there was like what the Able Team books was a spin-off as well. Yeah, so we
Phoenix
had,
Force we had, and Able Team sort of, and all those guys.
There were some sort of British equivalents of that. Reading Ian Fleming a lot, obviously. Bond was a very kind of Bond was a bonding experience for me and my parents. So like, you know, it was like a family thing. It's like every time a Bond movie came out at summertime, when we were on vacation, we would go and watch a James Bond movie. And the other thing was Sergio Leone westerns and kung fu movies.
Oh yeah,
Enter the Dragon. Yeah. You know, double bill of Enter the Dragon and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That was kind of like, you know, that sort of thing.
Nice.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. What a great combination. I know what I'm watching
that
this afternoon.
That was kind of like those things were sort of
those two together.
Action adventure. I think I kind of, you can say a lot of the stuff. I think it would be true to say that we all kind of picked up on the inheritors of the kind of the pulp action adventure sort of tradition. In the 70s and 80s when we were growing up.
It sounds like each of you has had an opportunity to actually go and work on some of the things you grew up with, which is it has got to be extremely cool. What's a place that you wound your career is taking you? You're in a situation and you're standing there going, okay, how did I get here? Right? Do you have those moments where you just go, okay, as my 10-year-old me would have loved to know that I'm standing here right now.
You know, every waking moment since I was
my guidance counselor. Yeah. My guidance counselor in high school owes me an apology. All right. That bastard. So.
Well, this is public. We can make this.
But, my mother and father never understood why I enjoyed Star Trek. They got that I enjoyed it. Right. They just didn't like it themselves and they tolerated it, but they indulged me. They're like, you know, mom, can I have a dollar for the poster book or can I get a dollar for the comic or whatever it was back in the 70s?
Oh,
I was indulged and watching the afternoon rerun of the original show every day after school was the loan exemption to the you have to do your homework before you can watch TV rule in our house. I was allowed to watch the Star Trek rerun. And so she never understood what I saw in it, but she was always cool with it. And then when I started writing Star Trek, she would even tell people, I don't have any idea what that's about, but he likes it and I'm his mom. So, and that's the kind of review she would leave on Amazon. I never read this book, but he's my son. 5 stars. You know,
it's very honest.
I love those.
Very honest.
You know, and I'm like, you know, yeah. And so, but yeah, she awesome. Would, what I didn't know at the time was she would buy a copy of everything I had done. And so she would put them on the shelf in her living room. And she was not a science fiction reader at all. She was more cozy mysteries and Harlequin romances and, you know, that kind of thing, historical fiction. So there'd be a row of these Star Trek novels on their bottom shelf in her living room. And her friends would come over and they'd be talking and chatting. And, you know, she'd tell me that they'd look at the bookshelf and they'd kind of look back and they'd. And then they finally get up the courage to ask, do you read that stuff? And my mom would go, no, but my son writes them. And then she would tell me, like, 8 times out of 10, the person would go, your son is Dayton Ward, the Star Trek writer? I love Star Trek. And so I'd end up packing up boxes of books to send to all her friends down in Florida. And until she finally figured out and put her foot down and says, I'm not giving you any more freebies. Go buy them at the store. My son needs the royalties.
So, you know, at 52, the same principle applies to my kids that applies to my mom now. Because one of my mom's friends could say that I'm cool, and then all of a sudden I'm cool. And the same thing happens with my kids. When they found out I talked to Kiefer Sutherland, they're like, ooh, he's done a bunch of video games. So it gave them credibility. But the principle applies on both ends of the spectrum, right in the middle.
Yeah. But I mean, there's days when I get off the phone because we've been talking about something Star Trek related, and I just kind of sit back and go, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. And I can't believe we just had a 3-hour meeting about something so stupid. But I mean, here it is, you know.
I mean, I can't just say what the project is, but, you know, just a few weeks ago, I was on a project where I was on a Zoom call with William Shatner.
Oh, wow. Another great Canadian.
Another great Canadian. And it was just a surreal moment where I realized, you know, I'm in a creative meeting and I'm just talking like a professional with William Shatner.
You're a colleague.
And every time he'd bring something up or he'd ask me something, I'd say, yes, sir, or no, sir. Finally, we get to the end of the call and he goes, so David, in case we ever talk again, you know, you don't have to call me sir. I prefer you call me Bill. I said, yes, sir. I mean, yes, Bill. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, I said, my whole life, you've been my captain. And he goes, and I still am.
Wow. Oh, please tell me you recorded that just for you to have.
No, it was a confidential business meeting.
Oh, so right.
Recording was not allowed.
Oh, okay.
But it was a moment I will remember forever. He was very charming. He just, you can feel the charisma coming off him, even over a Zoom call, you know, where he's relatively low energy and just talking business. You can still feel that intense charisma that makes him who he is.
He's still James Tiberius Kirk.
He is. He is still my captain.
It's his world, and we're just walking through it.
And he's also DJ Hooker, which is great. And Denny Crane.
And Priceline guy.
Oh, that's amazing. And he told you to call him Bill.
I mean, I don't know that I'll ever get to talk to him again in my entire life, but
I'd call him every day just to call him Bill.
Well, I mean, I don't have his number. I was dialed in by the production company. But, again, I can't go into details.
No, that's amazing.
I think it's unlikely that I will get to talk to him again, but I will remember that conversation as being
and mind-blowing. And he still looks great for how old?
He looks amazing. He's 90. He's 90.
Was he 90 now?
He's 90.
Canada should have shut down for that. I'm really surprised. We dropped
the ball. This guy is he looks like he's in his late 50s, early 60s. He has so much energy. It's unreal.
He looks better than me. Come on. He looks great. Jim, did you have a moment? Thank you. Well, Dave, appreciate that. Jim, did you have a moment or several?
I think Dayton's right there. There are kind of days when you wake up and go, I can't believe I'm being paid to do this stuff. And, you know, when I think back to the kind of the kid who, I found a photograph of myself a few years ago. It's from Christmas 1973. And I'm sitting in front of the fireplace of my house. In my little dressing gown, I've obviously just got up, and in my hands, I'm holding this little die-cast Starship Enterprise toy. That was my Christmas present. And I'm so happy. I've got this little toy. I'm flying it through. And I looked at this picture of this kid, and I thought, man, you've got no idea, have you, that little toy spaceship in your hand is going to, the places that is going to take you. Not just professionally, but personally. Is getting to make, you know, good friends like these two reprobates here.
Legitimizing also, your career, yes.
You know, meeting my wife through being involved in different kind of fan events and stuff like that, and all of the good friends that I've met through fandom. That's something that I kind of cherish. But in terms of an experience that kind of really stands out, is I've got to say, sitting in the captain's chair on the bridge of a starship, on the set of Starship Voyager, sitting on the captain's chair in there, and just thinking like, how is this happening? Well, how am I here?
Yeah, I got to do that for DS9.
But I think the one that I remember the most is I worked very briefly on a publication that came out at the time with the James Bond movie, Tomorrow Never Dies. And I'd been working for quite a while as a journalist, entertainment journalist, and writing prose fiction and stuff. And my family kind of knew what it is I did for a living, but they didn't really get it, you know, the same way as like Dayton was saying about with his mum. And I was on the set of the movie and watching Pierce Brosnan and Michelle Yeoh do this action sequence using live ammunition, and it was really loud, so much so that it kind of quite deafened me. And you know how your voice goes up a little bit when you're kind of like, oh my God, geez, wow, that was loud. And I turned around and Pierce Brosnan was standing behind me. He went, yes, yes, it was. Hi, Pierce Brosnan. Nice to meet you. Like, he said it to me as if I wouldn't know who he was.
Right, right. Right. Like, I'm kind of a big deal. He did exactly the opposite.
I've seen your pictures.
I'm kind of a big deal. It's like, in case you don't know who I am.
Oh, Mr. Bond, nice to meet you. Wow. And then after I did that, I remember I picked up shell casings from the fight scene. I took them. I gave shell casings to all my friends from the set of a James Bond movie. Here's shell casings that James Bond has used.
That's funny.
When the publication finally came out, I gave a copy to my dad, and finally he understood what it was I did for a living. Wow. Because he was like, well, this is James Bond. This is a real thing. That other stuff you do, that's so important. This is James Bond. This is a thing. You know? And I was like, thank you, Pierce Brosnan, for finally, you know, allowing me to bring this to my family and make them understand what I do for a living. Indeed, absolutely.
In retrospect, the James Bond stories are much more fictional than Star Trek. Star Trek's much more rooted in reality than the James Bond films are, for sure. But yeah, it gives you the credibility. It gives you the cachet. Yes,
definitely.
Wow. Yeah. Same thing. My dad and I, every time there was a James Bond movie, we would either go to the theater or we'd watch it at home. And I have great memories of watching that with him. So watching every of those films. So awesome. Well, again, I want to be mindful of your time. Keith, do you have any other questions or?
No, I appreciate all three of you, getting back to us and being able to join us today. That was awesome.
Is there anything else you're working on that you can talk about that, individually or collectively? No.
Well, there's that one. There's the one. There's that.
We're always working on them. We just can't really talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, we can talk about that then.
Oh, we can talk a little bit about that. All right.
You go.
Who wants to kick
us off? You're sort of the senior guy,
All right. I don't know about that. But so the three of us are working on a trilogy of Star Trek novels. That has been given the title Star Trek Coda, and its purpose is to push forward the ongoing continuity that we have been building in the novels for going on 20 years now. As I was reminded last night while reading Dave's manuscript, we've built this vast interconnected continuity between the characters of Next Generation, DS9, Voyager, and various other characters that were created just for the novels. And for, lo those many years, we were allowed to run wild with near total abandon with the blessings of the studio. But then this little TV show called Star Trek Picard that you may have heard of is back. And so as tie-in books usually have to do in these situations, we have to find a way to align ourselves with what's going on screen. The kind of like what happened when Disney bought Lucasfilm and decided they were going to revamp Star Wars. You know, it's a little bit like that, but we are taking a much different approach because we've been given an opportunity to kind of figure out what to do with the books and help them align with what we're doing on screen now. So it's not like Star Wars where they just said, all right, all that stuff is over. We're not doing it anymore. They gave us an opportunity, which is, I believe it's unheard of in this line of work. With the backing of the studio and the backing of our publishers. So it's been an interesting journey these last, almost 2 years now since we first started talking about it. And you have to wait till September for the first book to come out.
This September.
September 28th, I believe, is when the first book comes out. And then
October 12th.
Jim's book will come out this October 12th. And November 3rd. Book is in, I want to say, it's a pretty big gap.
November 30th. I'm not sure quite how that happened.
Yeah. I don't either. So, but the scheduling gods don't talk to us.
they do what they do. And I believe Picard season 2 drops in the fall, if I'm not mistaken, right? Oh, it is 2022.
Like 2022. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to come out next year.
Okay. I saw that they had leaked some photos of an appearance in
season 2. I believe Prodigy is probably coming in the fall.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think you'll see Prodigy before you see Picard. I think the poster that they released, the digital poster they released for Picard season 2.
And in this project, do you have to consider Discovery and all the other, Discovery? Well,
not so much. We have to
We had to consider a number of things.
We had to consider the things that affect continuity in the late 24th century.
Right.
Which is where most of this storytelling had been taking place. And part of why we had to undertake this project was that when Picard came around, they began establishing as elements of their backstory bits of history that happened in the intervening years between when we last saw them and where the series is then. And ultimately, those bits of backstory that were now being established as canon were completely incompatible with what we had done in the books. And try as we might, we simply could not find an elegant way to reconcile the differences in continuity. And finally, we just said, we're just going to have to accept that our continuity is not going to match with theirs. Ours is going to come to an end to make room for new tie-ins that are consistent with the current canon. The question was, are we going to abandon all of our stories unfinished in medias res, or are we going to find a way to conclude these stories in some sort of dramatically satisfying way that makes it look like we at least had a plan as we were winging our way through this for 20 years. And what's remarkable is that, you know, once you're tasked with finding an ending and you look at where you are and what your possibilities are, you suddenly realize you've been setting stuff up without realizing you've been setting stuff up. And suddenly opportunities, you go, well, that would be a great thing to do for, you know, a finish to the story. Oh, look at this possibility over here. Well, we got to do this with this guy. And, That was a lot of our planning, was realizing how many open story threads there were, but also open possibilities just with character relationships that were just waiting to happen. So that's been sort of a fun thing. But yeah, we are looking to essentially reward those readers who have been with us on this 20-year narrative journey.
Right.
And we just want them to feel like we gave enough of a damn to give you an ending to the story you've been reading for 20 years. It's not just going to suddenly go away into the
right. And what you're saying is that a move like this is unprecedented. It's not normal to take.
Normally a tie-in line. Normally a tie-in line would just say, all right, those books are done. Now the new books are going to track with this continuity.
Right.
Star Wars, you know, the publishing team made a decision to rebrand a lot of those books as Star Wars Legends.
Right.
And I guess part of why I guess that rankled some of the fans was that they had been being told for years that there were these degrees of Star Wars canon and that the books were part of that canon ecosystem. Whereas in Star Trek, the people who run Star Trek have always been very clear. The books are not canon.
Right.
They are official. Right. Yep. They are licensed. They are designed to be consistent with canon at the time that they are, you know, written and published, but they themselves are not canon. They've never made that promise.
Right.
So I think that is going to give us some freedom and some leeway to do what we're doing in CODA and provide a satisfying sense of dramatic closure.
Yeah. That was the big one, was making it clear, absolutely no doubt, to the readers who've been following us for all these years, that this is not time that was wasted. These stories matter. These stories are as relevant to you as the ones you see on TV, because you made them so, and we honor that. At least we're trying to as much as possible, because they matter to us. I mean, if we all have our visions of what is real Star Trek, but, you know, I'll fold in bits of the novel continuity and other places, they're just as real as you can be in a fictional construct. they're as real to me as any episode that I might like from one of the particular shows. There are elements of what we have created over the years that I value just as much from a story perspective. And there are fans who are, you know, they are extremely passionate about this. And to them, it's all the same. You know, like, this book happened. This adventure really did happen with these characters. And we're trying to honor that. It's like, yes, they matter. They matter to us, too. We, you know, our blood and sweat is in here. So we obviously are not looking to half-ass our way to the finish line. And, you know, make it matter, in not just in the context of the readership, but also, yes, this matters in the larger Star Trek book. You know, storytelling quilt. It's like, these are real stories that matter to you. They matter to us too.
Well, it's been, sorry, go ahead.
It's a tough gig. Tough gig, man.
It's an absolute thrill to hear how each of you and collectively and individually were able to navigate through two universes that have rabid fan bases and have fans love you and have fans, you know, that gravitate to what you're doing and support what you're doing. That's,
let's not get carried away.
I'm not saying all of them. We don't have to please everybody.
My work.
I don't think they love us.
Yeah,
we're not going to say love us. Anyone who's ever had the misfortune of meeting me loves me.
Yeah, we don't need everybody to love us. So. Come on.
The work, and I love their money.
That's right. Exactly.
Right.
Just to be honest.
I just need him to hate Dave a little bit more than they hate me, and that's, I need to be able to outrun Dave. So
I just need to be able to step on you to get to
me flee the bear of bankruptcy. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Right. How are we going to outrun these fans? I just have to outrun you, dude. And I'm good.
I need to know where the emergency exit and the broom are.
We've gotten to know you for the last hour or so. I've totally gotten that vibe, and I'm not surprised by that at all.
That's not even a question.
The last question I have, if Jack Bauer comes calling, are you going to jump back on the train?
Oh, yeah.
In a heartbeat. I won't even think twice.
I would take that ride again.
Typical barrister.